is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, October 12, 2004. Reality keeps rearing its ugly head, stated Bob Herbert, the New York Times columnist, on October 8th, in his Working for a Pittance statement. The Bush administration's case for the war in Iraq, he wrote, has completely fallen apart, as evidenced by the report this week from the president's hand-picked inspector that Iraq had destroyed its illicit weapons stockpiles in the early 1990s. The article, however, by Bob Herbert focuses most poignantly on what it's like for working people in the United States today. Reality check. The limits of choice in 2004, our Taking Aim program for this week prior to the Million Worker March, October 17th, Washington, D.C., the Lincoln Memorial. Ralph?
The article by Bob Herbert focuses on a particular study by the Annie E. Casey, Ford, and Rockefeller Foundations that show that, quote, 9.2 million working families in the United States, one out of four families in this country, earn wages that are so low that they are barely able to survive financially. Quote, our data is very solid, and it reveals that this is a far larger problem than people can imagine, said Brandon Roberts, one of the authors of the report, which is to be formally released today. The report found that there are 20 million children in low-income working families, and for the purposes of the study, any family in which at least one person was employed was considered a working family. And now, very wealthy families were included, so it skews the results. One out of four living at below survival level or poverty level includes, through its averaging, very wealthy families.
You have to note that a family of four earning less than $18,392 is considered poor. That's the federal poverty level. The median income for a family of four in the United States, and this includes the very wealthy, is $62,732, which is actually below what it costs to maintain yourself in the major metropolitan areas. The 9.2 million struggling families, notes Herbert, that are cited in the report fell into the category where they earned either less than $36,784, which is considered low income, or at the very poverty level of $18,392. What is important to note is that one-third of all children in America's working families fall within the low income and poverty level.
And again, let me emphasize here, these figures are extraordinarily skewed because this averaging includes the very wealthy. That means the billionaires are included in the averaging of what constitutes low income and poverty. And again, I want to emphasize that when you talk about poverty as a income of $18,392 for a family of four, that means in essence that something like $4,500 for an individual is considered poverty. We understand how utterly ludicrous such numbers are, because nobody can survive on $4,500 a year, and it is quite apparent that these figures, the actual percentages of people in poverty in the United States are multiples of this, because $36,000 for a family of four is not low income. It's not survival. You cannot survive in the United States on $9,000 a year, let alone $4,000 a year.
Before we return to this study that was done by the Ford and Rockefeller Foundations, let's look at a major metropolitan area. That is the San Francisco Bay Area. Just a few days before the Bob Herbert article, an article appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle by Jason B. Johnson. This was on Wednesday, September 29th. And it noted that a study that it was conducted by the United Way in the Bay Area stated that 1 in 4 families can't afford basics, and the study found widespread poverty in the San Francisco Bay Area, which most people would not consider the picture of metropolitan poverty. The United Way then is coming to the same conclusion as this national study. 1 in 4 Bay Area families can't afford the basics of housing, food, health, and child care without government aid, according to the report by the United Way of the Bay Area. And the report is called The Bottom Line, Setting the Real Standard for Bay Area Working Families. What they were trying to look at was what it takes to be self-sufficient in the 9 Bay Area counties. Now, this is a region of almost 2 million households, and they found that that 500,000, half a million of them, are not self-sufficient. They excluded the elderly and disabled. They looked at poor working-class families. And what they noted is we're seeing the erosion of the working families, too. The federal poverty level, and they looked at a family of 3, which would be 15,260. We noted before that it's over 18,000 for a family of 4. And they said that an adult with a preschool age child that lived in Alameda, Napa, or Contra Costa counties would have to earn $20 an hour, or between $40,000 and $57,000 just to afford the basics. If you lived in San Francisco itself, you needed to earn at least $23 an hour, and $27 an hour if you lived in Santa Clara County. That's the home of the Silicon Valley computer industry. Ralph?
Well, what the article goes on to describe in a rather matter-of-fact way is the following. Family advocates and United Way officials confirm that many families have to choose between eating and paying their rent, even with government subsidies. Janet Brown, 49, has a struggle to make ends meet, even though she is receiving federal housing assistance under the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Section 8 rental voucher, a program, by the way, which is scheduled to be eliminated, and $800 a month in federal supplemental Social Security income. Large numbers of those who are in the poverty category or low-income category don't even have those meager supports. Brown, who is in a wheelchair after being wounded 5 times in a workplace shooting, said that she is not able to qualify for food stamps and she does not have enough to meet her family's needs. We have to either not pay a bill or pay another bill. We have to rob Peter to pay Paul. Housing and child care costs consume the greatest portions of household budgets. A single adult with no children must earn $11 an hour just to pay the basics, with housing accounting for 60% of the expenses. There's almost nothing left for clothing or food or the substance of daily life. This is the daily reality for growing tens of millions of people in the United States.
I want to reiterate what you would have to earn per hour just to be considered a self-sufficient household in the San Francisco Bay Area, and metropolitan New York area would be higher. Alameda County, almost $21 an hour. San Francisco itself, $24 an hour. $23.79 an hour. And in a more rural county, such as Sonoma County, $17.78. But in Santa Clara County, the home of Silicon Valley, $27 per hour. Now, let's go back to the Bob Herbert article, because in the national study, they found 1 in 5 workers, 20%, 1 in 5 workers are in occupations nationally where the median wage is less than $8.84 an hour. poverty-level wage for a family of four. A full-time job at the federal minimum wage of $5.15 an hour is not sufficient to keep a family of three out of poverty. Now, let's look at this again. $8.84 is the medium wage, while in San Francisco, you cannot be self-sufficient without a wage of $24 an hour.
What that entails is the following. Families with this kind of income, Herbert states, are teetering on the edge of an economic abyss. Any misfortune pushes them over the edge. An illness, a car breakdown, even something as minor as a flooded basement. For families in these income brackets, life is a harrowing day-to-day struggle to pay for the bare necessities. Federal government statistics show that the median annual rent for a two-bedroom apartment in major metropolitan markets is over $8,000. $8,000 when the actual poverty income of an individual is $4,000. A two-bedroom apartment, $8,000. The annual cost of food for a low-income family, over $4,000, and their utilities, over $2,000, and their transportation, over $1,500. There's no money for health care, no money for child care, no money for clothing. As Herbert states, you do the math. These millions upon millions of poor and low-income families are condemned to penury and desperation. And these families are going to go into shock, he writes, this winter as the price increases for crude oil translate into huge profiteering jumps in home heating bills. That means people will not be able to heat their homes in winter. The economy relies heavily on the services provided by these low-wage workers. And indeed, that's the understatement of the year, because the entire society runs on the sweat labor and the wage labor and the virtual slave labor of the socially impoverished in the United States.
71% of low-income families work, and more than half are headed by married couples. But as notes Mr. Roberts, one of the people who prepared the study, working hard, falling short, economic self-sufficiency in the United States remains maddeningly out of reach.
And as Herbert, who is actually a liberal and a Democrat, states, even in a presidential election year, these matters are not explored in any sustained way. We're quick to give lip service to the need to work hard and very slow to reward hard work. What we're talking about, of course, is the workings of the capitalist economy and the relentless exploitation that is endemic to it, of which the two parties are both the promoters, the creators, the rationalizers, and the sustainers.
And let's look how it is sustained. President Bush, in the debate the other night, was quick to note we are out of recession and that his administration is creating jobs despite the 2.7 million jobs lost since he took over the presidency. But what neither he nor John Kerry spoke about are the types of jobs, the quality of work that are being created and the jobs that are being destroyed. Dollars and Cents, in its March-April issue 2004, did an analysis of the new economy in the United States, the contingent economy, in other words, contingent upon work being available, and this is temporary work. They note it's divided in three types: agency temps, hired through professional suppliers like Manpower or Labor Ready; internal temps, employed by companies directly, and this includes companies such as Microsoft; and the corner day laborers who gather on street corners each morning hoping for work. Now, agency temps do not just do secretarial work or accounting work. Today, they perform industrial, warehouse, construction, and also other types of professional labor. In fact, many companies instead of hiring full-time workers, rely upon temporary industrial labor to keep their production lines functioning. Well, what about the shape of the U.S. economy? Recent government estimates of agency temps alone range as high as 5.3 million workers, compared to 1973, 30 years ago, when the economy relied upon only 250,000 workers, a quarter of a million, compared to 5.3 million today. Now, dollars and cents notes that turnover is as high as 600% in many temp jobs, but these figures are misleading. Industry reports show that more than 15 million workers, or 12% of the U.S. workforce, held temporary or contingent jobs at one time or another during 1998. And this, we have to note, really can't include all the corner day laborers because most of their work is off the books.
Maya, here is an article by Knight Ridder Tribune. It's the author actually is Holly Sklar, called Boom Time for Millionaires, October 3. The economy is booming again, if you're a billionaire. The new Forbes list of the 400 richest Americans has 313 billionaires, up 51 billionaires from 262 last year. And it recites, Donald Trump is just an average Joe amongst the Forbes 400. Trump's $2.6 billion puts him right about the average. Bill Gates leads the list with $48 billion, followed by Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett with $41 billion. The heirs to the founder of low-wage Walmart, the sweatshop king of the United States economy and of the world, holds down half the Forbes 400 top 10 spots, ranking numbers 4 through 8 on the list with $18 billion each. Now, Buffett is the chief economic advisor to John Kerry. And Buffett is the chief economic advisor to Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, who just recently vetoed a bill to increase the meager minimum wage. So it's very clear, it's very transparent who runs the show, who calls the shots, and the role of these politicians, Kerry, Bush, or whomever. It took a minimum of $750 million to make the Forbes 400 this year, and that's up. Now, what is $1 billion anyway, asks Holly Sklar. You'd have to rake in $1 million a day for 1,000 days to reach $1 billion. And the $1 trillion wealth held by the 400 richest Americans is more than the combined wealth of over 100 million households in the United States. And the article makes clear the boom time for billionaires is not for most Americans. The economy is said to grow, but the wages fall, poverty rises, and the working class sinks into desperation. As the Census Bureau reported, the number of Americans below the poverty line grew by over 1 million in 2003. It's 36 million, but $36 million. Based upon an assumption of $4,000 to $5,000 a year income to qualify for poverty, when in reality it's a multiple of four times that, five times that, six times that to be in poverty in the United States. The official poverty rate rose to 12.5%. It's truly more than 30 to 40% given any rational examination of what it takes to survive. And the article states the poverty rate would be far higher if the poverty were adjusted to realistically reflect the cost of minimally adequate housing, health care, food, and necessities such as child care for employed parents. Share of national income going to working people since last year was the lowest on record, with data going back to 1967. The share going to the bottom fifth was also the lowest on record. But households with incomes over $1 million will receive tax cuts averaging $128,600 in 2004. Their after-tax income will jump by multiples, widening the gaps stated below. So clearly, what we are looking at here is a federal tax policy that ends up transferring income share from the bottom 99% to the top 1%, the Economic Policy Institute reports. And as the Wall Street Journal put it, the tax cuts, which are supported now by both parties, the vote to sustain these tax cuts was 93-4 in the Senate. And that's all factors of each party mobilizing to sustain these tax cuts that they make rhetorical comments upon in fake debates. Whether it's Kerry or Edwards, when push comes to shove, they take the lead, and their party as well, in sustaining these tax cuts. The Bush tax cuts include a reduction in the top tax rate, as the Wall Street Journal puts it, as well as reduction in taxes on estates, capital gains, and dividends that hugely bolster the fortunes of the fortunate. That's the reality, the boom time for billionaires. The 400 members of Forbes and their corporations get the tax cuts while jobs are outsourced, profits are moved offshore, the national debt swells, tax cuts while teachers, firefighters get pink slips, tax cuts while the mass of the population sinks into desperation.
Ralph, I'd like to return again to the shape of the U.S. economy, what it means for American workers, the contingent workers, the shift from permanent jobs to temporary work. As I noted before, the industry reports that 12% of the U.S. workforce today hold temporary or contingent jobs, or held at one time or another during 1998. That's 15 million workers, 12% of the workforce. And as I mentioned also, the temp work used to be a clerical work, but now the agency temps, clerical work, is only 40% of the labor force, of their labor force. And 35% of the industrial of temp work is for an industry, and technical 11% and professional 6%. And this was noted by the Ford Foundation in a study by Nick Theodore and Chirag Mehta that they did in 1999. What it means in terms of weekly wages is important, because agency temps earn 64.5%, two-thirds of what full-time workers make. And it turns out they not only, of course, make less, they do not have the health benefits, they do not have pension, they do not have any of the elements that are necessary for long-term survival in the workforce. 70% of agency temps had no health insurance, compared to 44% of non-contingent full-time workers.
Here is an article by Daniel Gross in MSN Slate magazine on July 30th, 2004. Oh, that deficit? Why the Democrats ignore Bush's fiscal folly. And he states, keynoter Barack Obama never mentioned fiscal policy. The vice presidential nominee, John Edwards, spoke only of Iraq's debt, but not that of the United States. Clinton fiscal talisman Robert Rubin was seated next to Theresa Heinz Kerry. By the way, as we've mentioned before, Theresa Heinz Kerry and John Kerry own 51 corporations outside the United States that are paying sweatshop wages. But Kerry's nomination speech contained no reference to deficits, or, for that matter, what are called Rubinomics, because, in essence, Rubinomics represent reinstituting pay-as-you-go budgeting, which is a euphemism for slashing social programs, for cutting back on the public service employees. And what Gross calls the neo-economists, led by the supply-sider Lawrence Lindsay and the shameless Glenn Hovard, possess, quote, a revolutionary mindset used to find excuses to restructure the tax code, to eliminate taxes on savings and investments on the part of the wealthy. The result, hundreds of billions of dollars of the Social Security surplus spent, hundreds of billion dollars in extra debt, subpar job growth, structural deficits as far as the eye can see, a deficit economy that may reach the heights of $72 trillion overall dollars. All your income from working would be taxed, while none of your income from other forms of savings would be taxed if you're an ordinary American, but the breaks go to the wealthy. And that theme and that reality comes through no matter what source you use as your documentary base. Here is the article by Daniel Altman, Speeches Won't Trim This Deficit, October 10th in the New York Times. Maya.
Go ahead, Ralph.
Daniel Altman states, Mr. Kerry would start by restoring the top income tax bracket of 39% for people earning more than $2,000. But Kerry has proposed tax cuts to offset all of this gain. In other words, it's a shell game. He's handing back to them, just as the Senate and House did, very thing he purports to be removing. And indeed, it would be like buying nothing for 7 years each week. And indeed, what does Kerry say he's going to do to save money? He's going to, quote, cut the bureaucracy. That is to say, $156 billion, which is 2 million government jobs, a number requiring a very large axe. That's exactly what Clinton and Gore did with their downsizing of government, destroying public service jobs, public sector jobs, slashing away at precisely that sector of the economy that services the needs of the population and, moreover, provides well-paid union jobs to working people. The Democrats are in lockstep with the Republicans because it's a capitalist ruling class that is solving its economic crisis on the backs of the working people of this country. Either way, any kind of reduction that they talk about will be small potatoes when both candidates, and I'm quoting from Altman in the New York Times, talk exclusively about long-term fiscal problems that are actually larger than they begin to acknowledge. Just how substantially the budget position will deteriorate is indicated by Lawrence J. Kotlikoff, professor of Boston University, who calculates that we're talking here of tens of trillions of dollars. The debts will climb over decades. The country will be in a state of steady decline. The value of the dollar will drop. The ability to purchase will be minuscule. We are in the midst of an enduring crisis, which is systemic and endemic to capitalism as an economic order in the United States.
Ralph, I'd like to mention that when we talk about cutting federal jobs and also deregulation, which goes hand in hand with the policies of John Kerry and President Bush, I'd like to note that the decrease in union jobs of long-paying, high-benefit jobs in the airline industry with the major airlines, which are being undercut by the so-called low-cost airlines, low-cost today, low-fare, and the fare wars, that this deregulation did not start during a Republican administration, but was crafted during the Carter administration and was foremost plan of the Carter administration, the Democratic Party Carter administration. In other words, to undermine the union labor, which what they considered was too highly paid. And so now with the airlines, when they go through their bankruptcy proceedings or the threat of bankruptcy proceedings, the first thing they do is to tell the pilots, the mechanics, the flight attendants that they should take drastic changes. 23% drop in wages is what U.S. Air is requiring.
Well, the New York Times again on the 10th of October, Daniel Altman, both candidates' plans to handle the deficit fall far short. And it reiterates what Daniel Gross had begun to describe in the article I cited from July. Once again, the 39% shell game does not encompass the other side of the coin of handing back big tax cuts, once again permanently, to the same corporate ruling class. And $156 which $1 billion, which they purport to cut, will require 2 million government jobs to be slashed. Again, reiterating what we've been citing before, this is an assault on working people.
We'll be back in a moment after the station identification. This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Reality Check, The Limits of Choice in 2004. Let's go to look at some of the tax benefits for the rich that are going on in Congress. The Wall Street Journal, October 11th, noted corporate tax measure nears passage in the Senate by Shala Murray, staff writer for the Wall Street Journal. U.S. businesses would see about $100 billion in relief. In fact, it's $136 billion. The sweeping tax bill substantially alters the corporate tax code and provides new relief. Yes, new relief. They use the word relief, but what it is a gift to U.S. manufacturers and other businesses. And the House and the Senate stayed late. They are chafing at the bit because they want to go on the back to their home states for the elect to prepare for elections. But they were not going to leave until they passed this new corporate tax code and the benefits for the corporations. They had no choice, in fact, because the WTO had noted that the U.S. was in violation of the World Trade Organization rules, the ruling that 1,600 American exports to Europe's are in violation and because of an annual subsidy that the U.S. makes to exporters. So this bill, which in a Sunday session, the lawmakers voted 64-14 to restrict the debate so that they could come to a vote on Monday. And the bill gives, it caps the top rate for corporations, for these manufacturers, at 32%, which is an effective 3% rate cut. Now, it's not just struggling manufacturers. In fact, it includes, and I say struggling like that sarcastically, it includes the oil and gas businesses, as oil goes to $53 a barrel, engineering firms, construction, architectural firms, and large farming operations, and as well, there are always the little perks for friends of the legislators.
This bill just passed for a yet even larger tax break for the huge corporations is described as follows. This package is a magnet for scores of business breaks that have been queued up for several years awaiting just this must-pass legislation. And it describes as the effective increase in rate, as Maya mentions, a new top rate of 32%. But among the highlights are a one-year tax holiday, and for the repatriation of foreign earnings at a top rate of 5.25%. 5.25%? Minuscule for corporate profiteering. Corporate profiteering that's offshore. They repatriate any money that they want to spend in the United States. They pay a 5% rate. Who pays 5% in the United States? Not even the poor. Are paying as small a tax rate as that. The multinational corporations will receive a further $43 billion in tax breaks. This is a corporate soup line, and the parties, the two political parties, the Democratic and the Republican parties, are in collusion, no matter the rhetoric, no matter the pseudo-verbal clashing in the debates. Push comes to shove. When they get down to preparing the bill, when they get down to voting, both parties line up in lockstep to hand the corporations hundreds of billions of dollars while poverty expands and deepens and extends and becomes endemic in the United States.
Ralph, even Senator Edward Kennedy, Democrat from Massachusetts, had to note, quote, the bill is for the corporate for the elite corporate interests. It's a lobbyist dream and a middle class nightmare. In addition to the $136 billion in new tax breaks for businesses and other groups, and remember that this just sets a ceiling from where the corporations go, because many of these corporations don't pay taxes at all, something we've discussed in prior Taking AIM programs. But it just means that instead of starting at a higher rate, they're starting at a lower rate from where they're going to get their write-offs to increase their profits. There is also in this bill $10.1 billion buyout for tobacco farmers. And what has been noted by the New York Times over and again is that the money isn't even going to tobacco farmers to buy them out so they won't produce tobacco. In fact, it's going to the corporate and family landholders who lease out their land to tobacco farmers. The original intent of this buyout for tobacco farmers was to give the Food and Drug Administration the power to regulate tobacco. However, the strong tobacco interests shelved and canned and cut the that version of the bill. And this is no longer in it. So, in fact, the bill is only a $10.1 billion giveaway to the owners of land where tobacco is grown.
And while this is going on, the Wall Street Journal reports on September 21st in an instructive article called Anatomy of a Hospital Bill, uninsured patients face vast markups on small items. The rules are completely crazy. How much does an overnight stay at a Virginia hospital cost? Paul Shipman is paying $29,500. He experienced severe chest pains during the night. He was taken to a community hospital emergency room. The doctors did a cardiac catheterization to unblock a coronary artery. He gets a bill for $29,500. And indeed, the article examines that the thousands of dollars that were assigned to him bear no relation to the actual costs to the hospital itself. They are basically raping and ripping off the dependent working class poor who, facing a medical crisis, go to an emergency room, wind up in a hospital for a night, and they're saddled with this. Indeed, what the article makes clear is that the overcharging is of such magnitude. It breaks it down. $7,560 charge for a stent that costs $39.15. $7,560 for a piece of hardware that cost $250 to the hospital itself. And it goes from every aspect of that medical billing, and it's endemic. It's the ripping off of the poor and the saddling them with obligation that has nothing to do with cost. It is a medical system that has nothing to do with treating people and everything to do with ripping them off and saddling them with debt from which they can never escape.
In fact, whenever anyone talks of these politicians about health care and their proposals, be it the Clinton administration or John Kerry with his discussion of extending health care to more people and giving them a choice, none of these politicians really address the real issue, which is the private control through these insurance companies of the health industry. They don't consider the enormous amount of money that goes for profit and goes for administrative costs. Nor do they consider the stranglehold of the multinational pharmaceutical companies and what that means for health care and the provision of health care. Another factor that isn't considered is preventative health care, what people eat and how with the television industry and also the fast food industry, how this promotes obesity in the United States so that more than half of the U.S. population is obese. That is more than 20% overweight, and this involves drastic, fatal heart conditions and other serious cancer conditions for the American population.
Well, now this has to be set against the other side of the coin, which is the absolute commitment of the Kerry camp to increasing the number of troops in the Middle East and increasing the military costs thereof. In the debates, one of the points that Kerry made was that he has the backing of our Army Chief of Staff Eric Shinseki and General Zinni. Well, this is what the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London disclosed on October 9th. What is Shinseki calling for? An increase to the number of troops from 400 to 500,000? From 400 to 500,000? And Colonel W. Patrick Lang, Defense Intelligence Officer for the Middle East and a veteran intelligence professional, stating U.S. combat intelligence has to up the ante and increase the number of special forces. And what is Kerry called for? He's called for a doubling of special forces. And meanwhile, Democratic keynote speaker Barack Obama not only calls for missile strikes on Iran. Here in the Chicago Tribune on September 26, Barack says he favors the use of, quote, surgical missile strikes against Iran. And he said in the event of a potential coup in Pakistan, the United States should attack immediately that nation's nuclear arsenal. Kerry, Barack Obama, party leaders attacking Bush from the right with respect to Iran, with respect to Pakistan, with respect to North Korea, speaking about the necessity to increase the number of troops in Iraq, and the numbers become very clear when you look at what the generals they cite are actually calling for. The International Herald Tribune on the 10th of October states plans, which are backed by Kerry, for the seizure of 30 cities and towns in Iraq. The overwhelming force to seize these towns. Maya.
Ralph, on Wednesday, October 6th, in the Knight Ridder newspapers, Patrick Kirster noted, U.S. soldiers will remain in Samarra indefinitely. As many as 1,200 American troops will have to stay in what are called the former insurgent strongholds, such as Samarra, indefinitely to prevent the city from slipping back under insurgent controls. And this came from both American military commanders and the Iraqi officials. Although they say there was a smooth takeover of the Sunni Muslim city, the Iraqi troops were involved in that, but they cannot depend upon the Iraqi troops to maintain control. In fact, American troops will stay there indefinitely. And staying there indefinitely brings us back to General Anthony C. Zinni, the retired Marine general who served as commander-in-chief of the U.S. Central Command from 1997 to 2000 and was a special Middle East envoy from 2001 to 2003. He spoke in New York at Hunter College last week, and this is what he said. Now, remember that John Kerry quotes Zinni's support over and again. Zinni said in his speech last Thursday that he expected American troops to remain stationed in Iraq for 5 to 10 years. I repeat, 5 to 10 years. In his estimation, that is what it was going to take. And he echoed the remarks of L. Paul Bremer, the former U.S. administrator in Iraq, when he said that the U.S. never had enough troops on the ground. Again, the Shinseki proposal that you needed at least 200,000 troops. In fact, they believe you really needed 500,000 troops. And what Zinni said, quote, I think we are still paying the price.
That's the meaning of the article in the Los Angeles Times on September 30th. The foreign policy divide is slim for Bush and Kerry. The goals are similar. The means may differ. They may not be in the same zip code, but they're in the same area code, said James Lindsay, Director of Policy for the Council on Foreign Relations. And it lays out how both these political figures are in lockstep about using all military power not only to, quote, win and kill in Iraq, but to extend that policy to the provocations against both Iran and Syria. And indeed, the San Francisco Chronicle, Iran as the nuclear boogeyman, draws the conclusion that the same set of drumbeat pretexts for the attack on Iraq are now being geared up in high motion for the same preparation for direct attack on Iran. Preemptive strike is what Kerry calls it. Preemptive strike is what he embraces. And the article by Jim Loeb on October 8th drives the point home. It says, had we seen the war for what it was, we would not have started with Iraq, but with Iran, the mother of modern Islamic terrorism, the creator of Hezbollah, the ally of Al-Qaeda, the sponsor of Zarqawi, the sponsor of Fatah, and the backbone of Hamas. This is Michael Adine of the American Enterprise Institute, Attack Iran. And these are the neocons, indeed the neocons who have been supposedly the instrument for the Bush policy, driving no less the policy of a putative Kerry administration, lobbying for a, quote, pending Syria Liberation Act, which will commit the U.S. government to regime change in Damascus. It's not just Karl Rove who is reporting for the War Hawks in the Pentagon and Dick Cheney's office. It's also Colin Powell and Richard Armitage, and it's the generals. It's the generals who Kerry invokes. State Department and Central Intelligence Agency all geared up. The Committee on the Present Danger, a neoconservative lobby group, is not out in front. The Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, FDD, a group that was created 2 days after the September 11th attacks, whose large reviews, the article tells us, mirror those of Israel's running Likud, has never abandoned its agenda. They are now preparing for Iran and Syria and the Saudis as well.
Meanwhile, in the United States Congress, there is legislation to revise the Patriot Act. To revise the Patriot Act, to reinforce elements of it that go against our civil liberties. And remember, over and again, both John Kerry and President Bush agree on the value of the Patriot Act. Let's look at what some of the legislation, some of it put in place by Democrats as well as Republicans, would do. Establishment of a national ID card disguised as a national standardization of driver's license. Establishment of a national electronic database for birth and death certificates with permanent identifying information assigned to each individual, such as a national ID number. Biometric identifiers, including fingerprints, face recognition, software photos, iris or retinal scans, and other private physical identification for travel documents, which would be used for security and domestic travel as well as for overseas travel. And as you know, this is being tested for business people who want to go quickly through the security lines. Expanded secret eavesdropping and search powers to be used against individuals suspected of so-called terrorist activity, whether or not the individual is associated with a foreign power. Further weakening of privacy rights in medical and personal records and removing all federal oversight. And enhanced material support provisions which allows guilt by association, removing habeas corpus for those detained under repressive immigration measures. Now, these are only some of the legislative measures and amendments to the Patriot Act that are now before Congress.
Maya, when the leadership of the AFL-CIO in June stated that they agreed with the aims of the Million Worker March, but that the timing was wrong because of the election. And they urged Labor not to endorse and to support the march, notwithstanding the fact that there's been an avalanche of support from rank-and-file labor across the United States. The Million Worker March Organizing Committee responded as follows. Why would the leadership of the AFL-CIO feel threatened by labor mobilization that confronts the crisis facing working people in America, that seeks to reverse the wholesale attacks on our living standards, our social services, our housing, our health and education, while challenging the diversion of trillions of dollars derived from the labor of working people to fund permanent war over decades and a brutal war for oil and occupation in Iraq? We say that only by acting in our own name can we build a movement that advances our needs. The very formation of the trade union movement was the result of independent organizing and mobilizing of working people. The struggle for industrial unionism, the movement for women's suffrage, the great movements for civil rights, all these flowed from the will to mobilize independently and in our own name. Will the defeat of George Bush result in this? Our aims include an end to the corporate trade agreements that pit workers against each other everywhere in a mad race to the sweatshop bottom. Will the defeat of George Bush change this when the Democratic Party brought us NAFTA, MAI, and Fast Track, with Disney and JCPenney paying Haitian workers 21 cents an hour? Will the defeat of George Bush end privatization and the destruction of unions in the public sector? When the Democratic Party privatized and outsourced our jobs under the rubric of downsizing government? And now, as we mentioned, Kerry promises to remove 2 million jobs once he's in office from the public sector. What were downsized were our social services, while corporate profits in the military sucked trillions of dollars taken from the sweat of our collective labor. Will the defeat of George Bush bring a crash program to restore our decaying and devastated public schools, or replace them with state-of-the-art public education in every community in America? Will the defeat of George Bush result in the rebuilding of our inner cities with free, modern, state-of-the-art housing and an end to homelessness? Will that presumptive defeat see the launching of a national training program in skills and capacities that enlist our people in rebuilding this country? Will it end the criminalization of poverty or abolish the prison industrial complex that destroyed generations of black and Latino youth? Will the defeat of George Bush roll back the bipartisan union-busting and anti-labor legislation, such as Taft-Hartley, on the books for 67 years? Will it secure us free modern transit in every city? John Kerry has called for an intensification of the so-called war on terror by, quote, targeting people before they act, unquote, giving explicit sanction to secret arrests, detention without trial, and the labeling of opponents of terror as terrorists. Will the removal of George Bush preserve the Bill of Rights, repeal the Patriot Act, Anti-Terrorism Act, and the repressive legislation that is setting the stage for a police state? Will that defeat recover $4.4 trillion that disappeared from the Pentagon and the Department of Defense as the military-industrial complex loots and hijacks government in America? Will his defeat bring the troops home now? Or is the plan after the election, as widely reported, whatever rubric of disguise, for conscription of working-class youth and an expansion of militarism? The United States Senate voted 98-0 to hand the Pentagon $416 billion, and days earlier the Senate voted 93-4 to increase troops in Iraq. And shortly before this, the Congress approved an initial military budget of $1 trillion for the next decade. And so it goes on. When $1 trillion represents $1,000 a minute since the birth of Jesus, we ask, will the defeat of George Bush recover these looted funds or stop the siphoning of trillions of dollars into the arms industry perpetually, leading inevitably to even more drastic cuts in all social services? That is what is at issue here. The real election, brothers and sisters, is on October 17th. With the mass mobilization of working people at the Lincoln Memorial 36 years ago, Martin Luther King summoned our people to a great poor people's march on Washington to address a system in crisis and to confront the hijacking of our government and our country by a banking and corporate oligarchy that has captured the two political parties in America. And that is what is at issue for us, brothers and sisters. It is the mobilization of rank-and-file working people in a movement that has the potential of becoming a political vehicle for fundamental change in the United States. A clean break, no longer under the jurisdiction and control of the one big property party with two names, opening the way for people to have a real choice, empowering us to struggle for fundamental social change. Those are the stakes. That's what the mobilization is about. Get on the bus. Make your real elective choice to begin the fight back, because believe me, brothers and sisters, no matter which politician is named president, the same corporate banking oligarchy will call the shots, the same National Security Council will dictate war, and the same Patriot Act will be imposed and shoved down our throats.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Reality Check, The Limits of Choice in 2004 will be available in our archive at www.takingaim.info. Audio tapes and CDs are also available. You can contact us at takingaim@pacbell, that's PACBELL.net, or takingaim@wbai.org. You can write to us at P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, California 94591, or call us at 707-552-9995. We'll be with you next week. You know what I'm going to give you? I do what I need. Tatan ta chinda karo, tatan ta. Ilon nok mi wala.